Welcome to Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. Today's guest, Janice Chen, wasn't interested in building just another gene editing company. Coming out of Jennifer Doudna's lab, she co-founded Mammoth Biosciences to take a broader bet on CRISPR, building a discovery platform meant to unlock new enzymes, push forward new gene therapies, and ultimately redefine the future of gene editing.
Janice, thanks for joining us on Transcribed.
Thanks for having me.
You said that when you and your co-founders set out to build Mammoth, you didn't want to build yet another gene editing company. Can you share Mammoth's founding story and the moment that you knew you had something special?
Yeah, so Mammoth was founded in earnest in 2018. So this was, right after my co-founder Lucas and I finished grad school. We were in the Doudna lab starting in 2014. And so, as you can imagine, that was a period of time just after, you know, the seminal CRISPR-Cas9 paper was published by the, Yannick and Jennifer and Charpentier and so on. So it was a very exciting time in the space. And I think the founding of Mammoth sort of starts, you know, during our time in grad school. And I say that because it was really the Wild West in the field where there were a lot of exciting questions, a lot of unknowns. You know, the Cas9 discovery had been demonstrated that you could program, you know, CRISPR to target any DNA sequence. And so that really opened up this tremendous potential, and everyone, you know, started to imagine what this tool could do. When we were in the lab, our primary question was around, well, for me in particular, was really trying to understand this amazing Cas9 protein. So, I started in the lab really understanding this molecule at the atomic level, like really understanding how this enzyme was able to interrogate DNA sequences and actually decide when to cut that sequence versus, you know, when not to cut. Because a big question at the time was, how does Cas9 actually decide between an on-target versus off-target cut?
This was your PhD thesis?
This was my PhD. And of course, the PhD covered a lot of different things, but I think that was really the foundation of where we began. Lucas and I actually, we were baymates. So we sat next to each other in the lab and we were constantly, collaborating, criticizing, questioning. And I think that, collaboration and friendship, I think, was also the genesis of us thinking about what can we do with these technologies. So, you know, then we partnered with Trevor, later on when he actually came from Stanford. So this is one of the rare Berkeley-Stanford partnerships that has emerged in the Bay Area. But we really recognized that we both had a similar vision of where we wanted CRISPR to be, which is beyond just, a single enzyme or a single application, but really thinking broadly about the technology.
When in your PhD did you have the suspicion this could turn into a company, or did you know from the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I had no intention of starting a company when we first started. When I was in grad school, my whole goal was really trying to understand this molecule, really thinking deeply about the mechanism, and through that process came across all of these different enzymes. I think, in partnering with Lucas and other collaborators, we realized that, the CRISPR system is a adaptive bacterial immune system, right? And so there's, this whole history of evolution that has, generated a really elegant immune system, which was, as you know, repurposed for gene editing. And so I think kind of tapping back into that evolutionary history, we realized that there was really a gold mine of different enzymes that could be repurposed. So I would say, we were slowly kind of building the thesis of Mammoth of, okay, you can actually go and discover new systems, characterize them, understand how they work in the laboratory, and through that process, figure out what applications they could be directed to. So, I mean, the catalyst for us to really think, hey, there's perhaps like a real real-world opportunity was kind of twofold. I mean, as you know, we were the first to show that certain DNA DNA targeting enzymes could be used for detection, right? So this new emerging field of CRISPR diagnostics was sort of that first hint that there was sort of this real-world commercial opportunity. And the second was these really tiny Cas enzymes that at the time people were, sort of said, these are artifacts, like, just a non-functional enzyme. But we actually went through the process of saying, actually, let's understand how they work, and ultimately demonstrated they could be used for CRISPR therapeutics. So those are sort of the two things that made us go aha. And I think being in the Bay Area, being in Jennifer's lab, also seeing alumni, you know, in her lab launch companies, I think made us recognize, like, you know, there's nothing to lose, right? You're a grad student making like 30K a year. Like, if this thing doesn't work out, like, you're no worse off than where you started. That's,
gene editing's obviously been this incredibly successful scientific tool, but it's been a tougher road as a therapeutic. It definitely feels like we're in sort of the trough of disillusionment right now when it comes to gene editing. What's your, like, where do you see the field heading from here?
Yeah, I think it's always important to put it into context, right? So the first discovery and demonstration of gene editing was in 2012, so just over a decade ago. And then the last, you know, five, 10 years has really been about reducing that to practice in specific applications, the first of which was gene editing therapeutics. And so, you know, we have that historic FDA approval just a couple years ago. And I think there are many companies that are in, you know, pivotal studies to show this curative effect, you know, that you can do with gene editing and really addressing disease at the root cause at the genetic level. So I think, like you said, from a scientific level, that's extraordinary. The fact that we can actually understand the underlying disease pathology from a genetic level and then correct it with this technology is...
It's actually insane when you say it like that.
Yeah, like I don't think when we first started, certainly when I first started, that was...
You weren't thinking like I'm going to cure diseases.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was clearly like an opportunity, but no one had actually shown that was possible. And then through really dedicated efforts, not just from the companies, but all the research groups that were showing, you know, and moving this technology forward, I think it's been a huge milestone for everybody. But, you know, we can't ignore the fact that gene editing has gone through a pretty rough period in the, I want to say in the recent couple years, but I think this is more of a reflection that it's a new modality and, you know, these things take time to prove out. You know, it's a typical hype cycle curve, right? You've got, you know, a ton of excitement and, as you mentioned, this trough of disillusionment.
The slope of enlightenment coming soon.
Slope of enlightenment coming soon. But I think there's a couple questions that people are still trying to triangulate. The first, safety is top of mind for everyone, right? I think... especially given, you know, Intellia announced patient death, it's a real wake-up call for all of us in the industry around, hey, like, we cannot compromise safety as you move forward new technology. So I think no one, you know, was willing to compromise safety, but it is a stark reminder that that is a important, hugely important consideration for this technology. I think the other part that has been met with some criticism is the business model. And I think this is a very complex situation because our current healthcare system doesn't incentivize cures, doesn't incentivize prevention. And in reality, I think that's where, you know, CRISPR technology in its full potential is going to prevent disease, right? Eliminate certain genetic disease, cure disease, right? And so these are new concepts that are you know, insurance, you know, companies don't know how to handle, right? I mean, we just haven't incentivized that kind of medicine. So I think that's really, it's going to be not just the technology, it's the combination of, you know, first demonstrating the safety and efficacy, then, you know, ensuring that you have ways to pay for the medicine and really demonstrating like the value of what that brings to society.
Yeah. Mammoth is very well known for developing and receiving emergency use authorization for a CRISPR-based diagnostic test during the very early days of COVID. I think what's less well known is that you pushed to develop an assay in days before any lockdowns had happened and before any real outbreaks in the U.S., so before we even called it COVID-19. What gave you, can you take us back to that moment if you remember?
Yeah.
And like, what gave you the foresight and conviction that was the right priority for the company?
Yeah. So this was crazy time for sure. I mean, I still remember, so it was like in January of 2020, I actually ended up at a conference in DC. It was a biothreats conference. So you had, you know, leaders.
You're at a biothreats conference?
I was at a biothreats conference, completely unrelated to COVID, right? So it was kind of crazy to think.
Was anyone talking about COVID there?
So that's exactly what happened, right? There were some discussion around, hey, you know, there's growing concern around this novel coronavirus. Like you said, there was no name. At the time, you know, there were cases in China. There, I think there was less than 10 cases in the U.S., right? So it was in the earliest days of what this virus could mean in terms of pandemic potential. And so there was whispers around it, but I think no one was ready to sort of like, you know, press the red button and say, okay, like, you know, we got a reset here. But that was the first time, I 5 years ago that I remember hearing the leaders of these agencies, HHS and so on, talk about this thing, right? So came back to the Bay Area, had a long time collaboration with Dr. Charles Chu, who's an infectious disease physician and a leader in disease detection at UCSF. And actually, what ultimately sparked our decision to really move forward was that he had access to some of the first patient samples in California. So I don't know if you remember, there was a cruise ship that had docked in Oakland, and there was an outbreak on that cruise ship. And so actually was one of the first recipients of those samples, and their mandate was to, you know, detect and diagnose, you know, these patients.
Man, a lot of serendipity.
And yeah, so he gave me a call and said, hey, like, we have access to these samples. These are the first, you know, some of the first cases in California. Like, do you want to formally collaborate and develop a new test for this? And of course, like, it was no brainer.
Were your co-founders like, what are you talking about?
I
come
think
back from
everyone
a biothreats
like,
conference and you're like, we got to pivot to this thing.
I think everyone was a little surprised at how fast, you know, we decided to move. And again, I do give a lot of credit to Charles, who really is someone who's not afraid to move fast and, you know, take big bets. And so it was quite a journey and a whirlwind since then. But yeah, I think we all were like, well, you know, this is the right thing, not just for the company, but for society. Because as you know, there was no COVID-19 test at the time.
I hope the biothreats conference wasn't a super spreader event.
Exactly. I hope not.
Any learnings from the pandemic's kind of like move fast mindset that have continued to influence Mammoth over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it was a wild time. I mean, as you know, like, there was no way to kick the can on decisions, right? You had to decide at any given moment, not just for us, but in the collaborators that we had. Time was sort of the biggest motivator, and also, you know, recognizing that there was tremendous, like, you know, this virus was spreading really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And so we needed all the tools possible to be put into place. And the fact that we could contribute to that problem was also extremely motivating. So I think this combination of, like, trying to work on a problem that's bigger than just, you know, your company or even your specific field is sort of a lesson that I take with me. It's like, you know, if you really want to drive for something big, like, you can move fast with the right people, you know, in the room. I think the other aspect was, seizing the opportunity. Like, I think that there were companies that I think were moved too quickly, right? And that, I think, created you know, some blunders on the line. There are also companies that move too slowly, and that you miss the opportunity. I think we were able to find the right balance, but, you know, there are still things outside of our control, right? The market had changed, the market got saturated. Like, we also made the decision to say, look, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to invest our resources in developing commercial, just for example, like a commercial function, because, like, there was no that was not the need that was that we could serve at the time.
Yeah. When you were telling the founding story of Mammoth, you talked about Jennifer's lab a little bit. When you were grad students, the kind of landmark CRISPR-Cas9 paper had already come out, and over the next few years, I think it became increasingly plausible that she was going to get a Nobel Prize for the work. How did that change the lab? Like, how did it change the pace of discovery or the dynamics in the lab?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when that work was first published, and then when I started, I think everyone was sort of like, oh, it's too early for her to get a Nobel Prize. Eventually, she would get one. But
you were that confident feeling, even when you started, eventually she'd get one.
Eventually, yeah. And then I think it was clear that this thing was building momentum. But it's kind of incredible, because I don't think the Nobel was really the point, right? It was always like, how can we move this thing forward? And Jennifer, of course, herself got more. Her time was in greater demand, you know, from not just her students, but also outside of the university, and also opportunities with other companies. So I think her lab became highly recognized, right, for this breakthrough discovery. And I think that really was to our advantage, because as grad students, we could basically, you know, email any collaborators that, hey, like, I'm from the Downa lab, I'm interested in this problem. Mm-hmm. And, like, I can tell you, like, every single person would respond to the email, whether or not something happened. Like, it wouldn't just be, you know, an email that's sitting in the ether. Like, I think that was very exciting, you know.
So it opened a lot of doors.
It opened a lot of doors, for sure. And then in terms of the lab, like, when I first started, I would say the core competency was more, you know, biochemistry, molecular biology, RNA biology. And then over time, like, by the time I left the lab, the center of gravity shifted to our more translational work. So I think Jennifer's lab really started to recognize, you know, again, you needed, like, different types of scientific skills and problems to and ways to think about the problem. And so through both like, you know, postdocs and grad students joining the lab with like the more translational bend or collaborating with other labs or companies, like that translational shift, I would say, started happening the last couple years of my grad school time.
So I heard both you and Lucas finish your PhDs relatively quickly, like four years, which is that's pretty fast. Can you share any stories about Jennifer's like management and leadership style?
Yeah, 4 years was pretty. I remember when we started Berkeley, I was like, oh, the average is 5.5 to 6 years, and
you're like, I'm gonna beat the average.
Well, even we were thinking about it that way, but it was funny because, you know, looking back, it's like it was a pretty fast PhD. In fact, I mean, I just love my time in the lab.
996 in the lab.
I wasn't counting hours, but it may have sort of added up to that point. I mean, Lucas for sure was like a total robot in the lab, and I couldn't compete with him. But we worked very hard, and I wasn't because, you know, it was a sake of work. It's because we loved doing the stuff we were doing. But Jennifer has always been a huge role model, and she would be very thoughtful about pairing us with, you know, more senior grad students. And then over time, like, we became the senior grad students that then trained the next generation. So it was a very scalable process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing I think that's really special about Jennifer is that she always knew how to translate like the science, the data into like a bigger story. And that's one thing, obviously, that I think has helped CRISPR become so mainstream, is like her efforts in being that leader. And
like
so
being a really good storyteller.
Being a good storyteller and really just like tying the data to the broader impact. So I learned a lot from that as well.
I'm surprised by the number of labs I hear about where the students actually aren't paired up to collaborate. It seems like a surprisingly like easy way to like be like a more productive, like a lab where everyone's, you know, happier.
Totally. And that's why I think she could have, you know, she had a lab of 30, 40, I think, at the peak, right? And just like being able to ensure that everyone kind of had a ability to learn and grow.
Yeah. How did she, as the lab became like very renowned, how did she like maintain the culture internally?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I mean, I think she always had her priorities right. Right. She cared deeply about the lab and the science that was being done. So I think that was a crazy thing. Like, despite how crazy her schedule is, like, she will always find time to sit down with you and like look at your data, like look at the gels, like look at your interpretation,
really?
Help you interpret, right? Like, I remember, being like, this is like, you know, I'm walking to her with my lab notebook and we're sitting down like analyzing the data here, which is really amazing if you think about.
You've spoken before about how Jennifer encouraged you to start your own company. Can you tell that story? And specifically, I heard that she said you weren't shooting high enough. What were you planning to do instead?
Given
academic, and what other kind of advice did she give you?
Yeah, so I would say like around my third year grad school, you know, you start thinking about what's next. And I remember I was interested in biotech as a career and seeing, you know, like what are the opportunities of doing so. But of course, I was like, the natural question is like, well, I have no experience in biotech, so I probably should like do that first. So I looked at like internship opportunities, and I, you know, there was also like a course for third, fourth year grad students and beyond, like different careers like after your PhD. And so it was really interesting listening to everyone's stories. But I was like, okay, well, like I just need to understand like how does a biotech company even work. So I was looking at internship opportunities actually at Genentech and some other companies. And of course, you need like, you know, like a recommendation letter to actually apply for these things. So I was like, Jennifer, like, this is what I'm thinking. And she was kind of like, you know, well, this was also during grad school, right? So I would have to, it was a summer internship, so I'd have to stop the work in the lab, do this internship, return, and then hopefully not lose momentum. And she rightfully said, look, you are like on a roll here, right? I think I had just published a paper and I was working on another project. And like, there was clearly like line of sight to the next phase of my career. And I think she was basically like, look, this is going to slow you down. Also, you know, like there's a lot more that you're capable of, and think about what you really want to do. So she was the one who actually kind of put the pause at the time. You know, I was kind of like, oh, well, that's a bummer, right?
Like, I thought you'd give me a recommendation letter.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, I can't really, you know, I can't do this if I don't. And it wasn't because she wasn't supporting me. I think it was the opposite. I think she deeply supported me and challenged me. Exactly. Yeah. To be like, okay, like shoot higher. And that was where I kind of took a step back and I said, okay, like actually, I really should just focus on, you know, continuing this momentum. And then that was, you know, in that time was when We actually started to have like really in-depth discussions with Trevor and Lucas and Jennifer about starting companies. So in a lot of ways, like I think if she hadn't sort of challenged me and course corrected, like my trajectory could have been completely different.
Wow. Mammoth's been described as the number one holder of CRISPR IP. So
we'll take that. Yeah.
From the very beginning, you've invested in expanding the CRISPR toolbox, discovering new Cas enzymes with unique properties. How do you decide which are worth pursuing? And are there any especially like cool applications that haven't made the cut?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the benefit and the curse of a platform company is that you've got a lot of different dimensions to play with, right? So, but I think that's one of the special things that we always grounded ourselves in when we started the company was like, you know, every other CRISPR company out there has their one platform and their one specific focus area, which I think is good for helping you move quickly. But I think, you know, at the core of it, platform companies really can be built to survive the long term. And I think that's always kind of the mindset we've had. To me, the best platform companies are ones that can prioritize and actually prove the platform and actually, you know, get to that first, you know, proof that this is like a could be a product and that there's real world application utility. And so that's always been kind of the balance that you have to figure out, like how far do you push one thing versus how, you know, where do you kind of keep things simmering in the background? But in the early days, like, you know, we've always kind of had three, I would say, well, two pillars of the company, but in the core platform, right? The pillars being diagnostics, which has gone through its own history, and therapeutics, which that's been the core focus of the company today. But it's not that like the therapeutics effort wasn't always simmering in the background. Some of the applications that we looked at, actually, this is like taking me all the way back, but when we first started the company and we were looking at DNA detection applications, there was this interest in like detecting microbes for the oil and gas industry, because it turns out that like these microbes can induce corrosion and really just like damage the infrastructure of oil and gas systems. And so having like real-time on-site detection of these bacteria can be hugely valuable and just, you know, kind of save a lot of potential damage for these companies. And so that was one thing that we had kicked around, because you're like, okay, there's no regulatory pathway. There's a clear path towards proof of concept and potentially commercialization. So it made a lot of sense. But ultimately, we said, look, we've got to focus. Like, we are right now, we're going to be a human healthcare company, right? And so that sort of eliminated some of these environmental monitoring applications or agriculture. And it's not that we would never be interested in those. It's like, we'll put that on pause while we focus on healthcare.
Yeah. Now that you've announced Mammoth's first lead candidate, has the discovery engine slowed down at all? Like, how do you prioritize development of sort of new nucleases with advancing your therapeutic pipelines? The fundamental platform question.
Yeah, it is a fundamental question. Yeah, I mean, I think there's, it's all kind of the shift, right? So while when we first started, it was really like get the toolbox, right? And understand like what your technology is capable of. And then in selecting the lead, we kind of found the perfect fit in terms of, you know, speed to the clinic, de-risking of the core CRISPR platform, you know, something that's biologically de-risked and like you could actually target it and it would actually give you a detectable biomarker that has, you know, real clinical outcomes. And then, you know, I think those were some of the parameters that we were looking at in selecting the lead, which is targeting this gene called APOC3 for cardiometabolic disease. But in terms of like discovery, I mean, it's sort of how you define discovery, because are we, you know, still scouring the universe for new CRISPR enzymes? No, like that's not been the focus, but there's a lot of discovery around leveraging those core CRISPR scaffolds and trying to do, you know, different types of editing, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the beauty of the platform is like you've got multiple dimensions around the type of edit, the type of targeting, you know, tissues that you can target, the type, you know, of biology that you can go after. But also the other axis like is on the business development side, right? By having, you know, these different like potential areas of creating value, there's different ways of like doing deals. And I think that's one thing that we've also been really thoughtful about in the growth of the company, because like we obviously cannot do everything at the company. That's not practical.
Yeah, let's talk about those deals. Yeah. I mean, you have partnerships with Vertex, Bayer, and more recently Regeneron, who does not do a lot of partnerships. what have you learned about partnerships, and what do you wish you knew about them when you started the company?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think everyone like thinks about partnerships being sort of like a huge like validation, which it definitely is. But the other reality is like a partnership is a trade, right? You're trading something to get something for both sides.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you're early and you have got a new and nascent technology, you're probably trading more than you want, right? And I think that's the reality of how these things go. But I would say, you know, think really thoughtfully about kind of those first partnerships, because some of the trades I think that, you know, we made, we, you know, in hindsight, maybe I wouldn't have done that trade. You know, Regeneron was a much later deal that we did. And I think we were also very thoughtful about what are the things that we are putting on the table, what are the things that we're getting back, and then what is this, what is the long-term trajectory for the company? So that was like, I think, one learning. I think the other piece is like really signing on to the fact this is like a long-term thing. Like things are not going to work out as you first intend. Like there's always a honeymoon period, right? When everyone's like really happy to get this thing done, but that's just the starting point. Then it's like, then it's the, you know, the road of like actually making the science work and, you know, following all the ups and downs. So I think at the end of the day, like I've personally loved the partnerships that we've had, like in Regeneron in particular. Like I've had the most fun scientifically that I've like ever had in some ways, and it really brings me back to like the grad school days. But then there's like the operating side where, you know, the complexity of these partnerships can create a bit of a operating like headache, because you just got, there's just, you know, certain things that you've got to handle from not just a day-to-day basis, but sort of midterm and long-term. It's very opaque from the outside, but what I can share is that like we always want to prosecute these discussions like from the earliest stage, even if there may or may not be even a possibility of something happening. But it's also for us to understand like what are people looking for, right? So it helps us also like pressure test our own strategies. But, you know, taking Regeneron for as an example, I mean, we talked to that company like 2 years before the deal was actually announced. So these are long-term discussions. So you got to start them like very early on and continue to build that relationship.
Yeah, the press release doesn't really tell the full story.
They definitely
don't. It looks like
the
overnight success.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, this came out of nowhere. Well, yeah, actually, let me tell you, I had two kids by the time like this deal, you know, by, you know, today from when we first started with them. But, you know, in terms of like conversation. So the other thing too is like it's nice to be in a position of strength when they have these discussions, because we've also had conversations and potential deals where we actually said no, like we don't want to do this for a number of reasons. So like we do make sure that we have the discipline to, you know, we're not just kind of do deals left and right just for the sake of doing deals. But does it actually like play to our strength? Does it actually make sense for our strategy? So I think, you know, there's a lot of nuance, obviously, but yeah, I think we're always trying to keep our, you know, door open for these discussions. And I think that's also the beauty of the platform, where there's not only different ways to slice and dice the use case for the technology, there's always different ways to slice and dice like BD deals and like what you can, you know, get for, you know, the stage of the technology or the stage of the asset.
Since you all started Mammoth out of grad school, I'm guessing there are many times that you were underestimated because of sort of age or inexperience. Like, did that happen?
Yeah. I mean, actually, it's surprising. You'd think that people would be like, oh, like, I mean, maybe there's an element of like, oh, these are like kids trying to start a company. But I think in reality, like, it actually came to our advantage, because like we didn't have the same like baggage that some, you know, veterans have after years of you know, battle. But so that the it's good and bad. But I would say like
you start companies because you don't know how
exactly
hard it's gonna be.
You don't know how hard it's gonna be, and you're like, okay, like I'm gonna go all in and I'm gonna try to like create you know, there's no playbook, right? So let me just like build it from first principles. So I honestly think like, you know, it actually in some ways played to our advantage, because people were like really refreshed by seeing this from a new lens, and so we kind of like leaned into that, honestly.
Maybe contrast, though, did sort of having Jennifer on the founding team create any like outsized expectations or pressure on the company's success very early on that was hard to manage?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Jennifer has been hugely impactful for the company. It's, you know, you probably, it'd be interesting to do the experiment if we try to start Mammoth without her, right? Like, who knows if we would have been able to make the same progress. But because, again, she is just such a renowned scientist and leader in the space, and, you know, being from her lab and being able to be presented with these opportunities, like, it's hard to uncouple those two things. In terms of pressure, I mean, I don't think so. I think we've always been, again, very grounded in like, let's follow the science and follow the data. You know, let's make sure that we are really thinking about like what we can, like what sort of positive impact we can do with CRISPR. And so I think that like people love to like use these names and kind of define the company based on like scientific founders. The reality is like there's, you know, so much that goes into developing a drug or, you know, developing a technology, that those are elements to the bigger picture. But, you know, practically it's like, you know, there's sort of like a huge mm-hmm. amount of teamwork that goes into all of it.
Yeah. You said that CRISPR is going to touch the full continuum of healthcare, from sort of detection to treatment. You know, knowing what you know now, like which part of the continuum thing is going to have the biggest impact in looking forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's always early detection, mm-hmm. prevention, right? Like that's a challenge because I think our healthcare system incentivizes the later stage, right? Treatments and chronic care. But yeah, I mean, if we could just like shift that equilibrium to early detection, then I think that really, you know, is better for patients and payers.
How far are we from sort of CRISPR-based diagnostics becoming like super routine and available, like a pregnancy test almost?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the dream, of course. But the reality is, like, whether it's CRISPR or some other technology, like no one has really fully cracked that nut. I think we got close during the pandemic, but like, you know, we're still a ways away. I think like that we have to kind of walk before we run. One of the things that we, you know, in our shift in our company strategy, like while we're not developing and commercializing our own CRISPR diagnostics products, one of the things that we've, you know, decided as a company is like we're actually going to enable the ecosystem with our, you know, breadth of IP in this area. And so we've announced a couple of non-exclusive licensing deals to really enable other companies mm-hmm. who are fully focused on trying to solve this problem to use our technology, you know, and combine, you know, their core competencies to actually get these to market.
Any hot takes for gene editing over the next decade?
Well, I mean, so 10 years is a long time or a short time, depending on how you see the world. But my hope and dream, and I think it's achievable in 10 years, is like, you know, in the same way that we've eradicated certain infectious disease, I really do think that CRISPR has the potential to eradicate certain rare monogenic diseases. And it's just a matter of, again, like focusing, you know, incentivizing that work, focusing the effort. There are, you know, like I've talked to patient communities where there's, again, very small patient populations. You're talking about, I mean, we all know the baby KJ story, that's N of one, but there's even like, you know, N of let's call less than 100, right? Mm-hmm. Where very clear source of pathogenesis where there is no incentive for companies to actually develop, you know, CRISPR cures for that. But I think the administration is sort of looking at that differently. We'll see what's, you know, just talk versus action. But that really has a potential. Like if you could eradicate a genetic disease using gene editing, I mean, that's also Nobel Prize winning, right? If you think about it. So that's my hope for the next 10 years. And we'll see. I think there's going to be ups and downs to get there, but mm-hmm. I'm optimistic.
So your father's a scientist also, and finished grad school while you were growing up. And you've mentioned how you and your siblings would play in the lab, even learning how to run gels. I don't know at what age this was.
I don't honestly remember, but yeah, I was young.
Did you always imagine becoming a scientist?
Yeah. So yeah, my dad was a PhD student at the University of Utah. So I actually grew up in Salt Lake City. And he was a total lab rat, like literally just days and nights and weekends in the lab. So it was sort of like a normal thing for us. And oftentimes like I would, you know, instead of going home from school, I would like go to his lab and hang out there, right, until he was done with his work.
How
and then
old
we'd go home.
You?
This was probably elementary school, but
oh,
honestly,
wow.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't remember exactly how old I was.
See.
It just
picked up a pipette very early.
Yeah, picked up a pipette, and actually, you know, this is like, I guess the 90s. And so I still remember like the PCR machine in his lab, like there was like a robotic arm that would move between the different temperatures, right? Instead of cycling in the, you know, small box that we have today. But yeah, I mean, just like early on, you know, kind of just saw firsthand like what it's like being a scientist. I think I never made the decision to go into science because of that. I'm sure it played a huge influence, but you know, looking back, I think just having a lot of fun and seeing like how you could just go from mixing clear liquids to something that had like a meaningful impact is something that I do attribute to the early days of seeing my dad be a scientist in the lab.
As a kid, you also played competitive chess, often as the only female or the youngest person in the room. Your brother, Nathan, is famously an Olympic gold medalist in figure skating. Fun fact for everyone listening. Can you tell us more about your childhood?
Yeah, I mean, you just like kind of listed off like the, you know, the highlights. No, but Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a child of immigrants, and I think everyone who's a child of immigrants knows that your parents will sacrifice whatever it takes, right? Yeah. And so I'm deeply grateful for that. The one thing my parents were, I think, very thoughtful about was like ensuring that we had opportunities to try everything. So like, I think they were very thoughtful about not picking the path for us, but letting us pick the path.
Interesting.
Whereas I know sometimes, like certainly, you know, my friends who have a similar upbringing were like kind of shoehorned into one direction. I think that we had the freedom to try a lot of different things. But of course, like, you know, education's number one. You have to work hard. Like, you have to go after the opportunity. And I think, like, for me, as I have two young kids now, and it's like all of those values are fundamental. But I also think there's an aspect of like savviness that I think, you know, being like Chinese American and figuring out how to like navigate this complexity of like you're not, you know, really Chinese and you're not really like, you know, if you don't sometimes don't really feel like people see you as American. It's like this weird hybrid. But yeah, it's like, okay, like just define who you are and then just go after something that you care about. So
your parents didn't like pressure you to play chess or your brother to like become a gold medal, like, you know, professional figure skater.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of five. And so if anything, like, I think we just outnumbered our parents, right? So I think they were like they kind of put a menu of things in front of us. Like one, you know, we started playing chess because I think my dad found a chess set at a yard sale. And so he got interested in learning. And so he just taught us. And then we just had fun with it, right? Like a lot of these things when you do as a kid, you do it because it's fun. Mm-hmm. And eventually it became competitive because, like, you know, my brother, I would say my oldest brother was really good at it. And so he and I had a lot of fun with it. And so we both were like pretty good. So we wanted to push it a little bit more. And I think, playing chess has also been like super informative for me, thinking about like strategies, like thinking, you know, several moves ahead, not just like what's best for you, but what's best move for your opponent. And so I kind of like, there are a lot of these themes that I think like really apply to business. And it's, you know, I think one day I really should like try to dissect all of it and, you know, put it on paper or something.
What do you wish you knew when you were starting out with Mammoth? Like, what advice would you give to a grad student about to start a company?
Sometimes it's good to be naive, right? Like we were saying, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
And beginner's mindset's great.
So you just go for it. But no, I think it's really helpful to do like first principles thinking. Again, because you're hopefully not just following a playbook, otherwise, like, you know, you probably should rethink what you're doing. Kind of think about, you know, what makes the most sense given the information that you have. I think the other thing too that I heard recently is like, whatever you step into, like whatever you decide to do because you're passionate about it, you really want to solve a problem, then step out of it, right? Make sure you understand the bigger picture. Because I think sometimes as a first-time founder, like you can put like blinders on. You're like, hey, like I've got this most amazing technology. It's going to save the world. But then you step out, you're like, okay, well, the whole system is like, you know, stacked against you. So how are you going to navigate that, right? Like how are you going to figure out like if you're actually getting after something that somebody really wants and needs? So, you know, those are lessons that you really learn over time. But I think this aspect of like stepping out of it and not just like drinking your own Kool-Aid, I think is super important regardless of what you do.
That's good. Good advice.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for lightning round. Fun questions.
Okay.
In your opinion, what's the most game-changing medicine of the last 100 years?
So my husband's an anesthesiologist, so I have to say this one because it would be propofol, which is a fast on-off anesthetic. It's used in pretty much every surgery nowadays. And actually, I learned that it was only FDA approved in 1989. So this is well within 100 years. And I think that's, you know, the fact that it's so widely used in
What were people doing before medicine. Propofol?
Just bad, like poor anesthetics, you know. So yeah, you know, anesthesiologists love propofol. So I think a lot of patients do too.
All right, you can wave your wand, magic wand, and have a cure for anything. What do you pick?
Cancer.
Yeah. What's something about you that people would be surprised to learn?
I was really involved in the arts when I was young too. So I did a lot of, I'm a violinist, a failed violinist. I also was a dancer. So I did ballet, modern dance. You know, ended up leading the modern dance company through college.
Oh, wow.
Did a lot of performing arts.
You have a lot of hobbies.
Yeah. it was very involved.
What is your go-to opening chess move?
As white, d4, and as black, e6.
I like almost know what that means. in your opinion, which Nobel Prize winning discovery besides CRISPR will have the most impact on the future?
IVF. I think it's already having tremendous impact. Yeah.
And then who should we interview next?
Carolyn Bertozzi.
Ah, good idea.
I think she would be great.
Janice, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.